Final topic today is the oft-requested legal update. Will be presented by Nancy May Skinner, an attorney with the law firm of Fager, Amsler & Keller in the Latham office. Nancy has specialized in appellate law, as you heard earlier this morning, for over 15 years. In addition to her appellate work, she practices in the area of medical malpractice defense, insurance, and health care law. Nancy is a member of the New York State Bar Association, the Capital District Trial Lawyers Association, and the American Bar Association. She's published on topics including medical malpractice, appellate practice, and risk management. She also frequently lectures for the New York State Bar Association and various medical organizations in the areas of medical malpractice, risk management, and civil litigation. Nancy received her law degree from Albany Law School. And would you now please join me in welcoming Nancy May Skinner.
Sophie Martin, forward back.
You can use that.
That'll just do forward, okay. Good afternoon. I'm gonna be talking about what happened in the last year that's relevant to medical malpractice, trial work, defense work. Starting out with some statutory changes that have happened in the last year or will be happening shortly, some regulatory changes, then talking about some case law, court cases that have addressed the issues that are important to us, and then finally, what can we expect going into the coming year? So first, the requirement that controlled substances be prescribed by electronic prescriptions has the timing of that has been delayed, basically some delays traceable back to the DEA in getting things going. So now until March of next year, we don't have that electronic prescription requirement. The public health law has been amended in a number of ways. This first one, this little guy down here, is because it was instigated by tick-borne diseases, this legislation, and the need to try to come up with some treatments that are not yet universally accepted within the medical profession, some sort of experimental or new innovative treatments. So what this does is protect physicians who are using these types of treatments or modalities for their patients that have not yet gained universal acceptance and say they're not going to be subject to professional discipline by the Office of Professional Medical Conduct merely because they're using something that's a little bit unusual. You may have heard about people being on long-term antibiotics for Lyme disease, that sort of thing. So this is the type of situation. What it does, it says, if a physician is subjected to an investigation, it will be limited to a preliminary investigation if the sole basis for the investigation is that it's one of these unusual treatments. But there are three things that have to be shown for this to come into play. It does have to be shown that the treatment effectively treats a condition, that the physician is treating the patient for, and that it's not a universally accepted treatment. The next section of the public health law that I'm going to talk about that was changed was to bring parity to medical care that's provided through telehealth or telemedicine. So basically it says that practitioners have to be reimbursed at the same rates for medical care that's provided electronically or through telehealth as they would for in-person care. There's a lot of definitions that go with this legislation to try to define what will and will not be covered. Basically, a quick phone call or text message is not going to be covered. Telehealth is defined as, electronic information by telehealth providers, which basically under the statute covers any kind of medical care provider, MD, not MD, chiropractic, podiatry, basically any kind. There's a full list in the legislation if you want to take a look at it, but it's really all manner of medical care that's provided. And it's to deliver healthcare services. So it doesn't include a telephone call or a text, but it can include a telephone call or a text if it meets one of these other three requirements, which I'm going to talk about. It's telemedicine, it's store and forward technology, or it's remote patient monitoring. So just because you're on the phone doesn't mean it's not covered if there's a clinical give and take. So what's telemedicine? And what are these terms? Synchronous and asynchronous. Okay, synchronous means it's happening at the same time. So a telephone call is a perfect example of that. The conversation, the information is being given and a response is being given at the exact same time. There's no time delay. IM, chat, video conferencing, those are all synchronous communications. So telemedicine is synchronous communication, and it includes an assessment, diagnosis. It's similar to what you'd get if you were sitting in front of your physician in an exam room. It's just being done electronically. So that's telemedicine. Then store and forward technology, which also is covered and would also have to be reimbursed the same as in office care, is when there's an intermediary. So an example of this would be an x-ray. So your doctor sends you to get an x-ray, you go, or an MRI, and you go to the facility where the MRI is done. They create images and information, and then they, as another provider, an intermediary provider, convey that information to your provider. So it involves three steps. That's the store and forward. So you think of it as sort of like there's a stop along the way of that information, where the information is collected and then conveyed onto your provider. So images, and so by definition, this is asynchronous, right? Because it's not back and forth right now. It's, I'm going to take pictures, we're going to develop them, and then we're going to convey the information once a report has been prepared, an image has been prepared, onto the provider. So this would also, the asynchronous would also be email, something that it goes through a network, that kind of, a stop along the way, so to speak. And last is remote patient monitoring. This is typically used with patients who have chronic conditions that require a consistent monitoring, like home hemodialysis, or some heart monitoring might be done this way. So this is, there's two places here. There's where the patient is and where the monitoring is. So typically it would be a patient with a device in their home, and there's data being collected, and then that data is being communicated to the provider who's at a distant location. So that's remote patient monitoring. So all three of those are things that, especially in more rural locations, can be very helpful to healthcare providers. If patients, especially sickly patients, can't get into the office, there are these options that, that will be covered going forward. So with this change to telemedicine, the Department of Health and the Office of Professional Medical Conduct realized we need to give out some guidance to medical providers, because this is new to them, and how, there are some new legal issues and new medical ethical issues that we don't know how to deal with yet, because it's different than seeing someone face to face when they're in your office. So, so they asked them to come up with some framework for, you medical providers to utilize when you're practicing telemedicine. The most important of which is kind of basic, of course, it's the same standard of care. The same standard of medical practice applies. And the location of the patient is what determines where the care is being provided. Now, this is very important to medical providers, because if your patient is in Massachusetts and you have a New York license, according to this, you're providing care in Massachusetts. So that can get into some, problematic issues for licensing and for medical practice. There is some legislation currently, some federal legislation that's been proposed, allowing some limited practice over state lines to address this, and I'm sure you've heard the instance when somebody's on vacation in Florida and they call their doctor for a prescription, in New York. It's being looked at as to how to handle that situation, but it is important, if telemedicine is being provided, that the provider understand where the patient is when they are rendering that care, because that's where they're considered to be practicing. And then there's, of course, the same standard for follow-up care. In terms of, is it actually medical care, and would you actually have liability for the care that you're providing? There's a presumption that if there's contact between a professional and a patient, through electronic communication, that it's prima facie evidence of a physician-patient relationship. It doesn't matter if it's being paid for. It could be, sometimes when you call the doctor's office, you're not, the provider is not being reimbursed. That's not determinative of whether or not there's a physician-patient relationship. A medical record must be created and maintained. And this is one that we see in medical malpractice cases all the time. Well, why isn't that in the chart? Well, it was a Saturday when the patient called, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I rolled over and, you know, took the phone call. Well, you still have to make a medical record of those communications that are done electronically. And then, because the patient doesn't really know who they're talking to, maybe they have a long-standing relationship with you, Dr. Smith, so if you get on the phone, they're going to recognize your voice. But what if they're talking to your PA or your nurse practitioner and you've never met them? If there's an electronic communication of that nature taking place, there has to be some identification provided to the patient so the patient understands who is this that I'm talking to. Much like a name tag would provide a patient if they were in person. So if there's any email being communicated or messages being communicated, it's important that the provider be identified. So there's also been some regulatory changes in the last year which are relevant to our practice. One of them is a new term. Instead of physician's assistants, it's now licensed physician's assistants in New York. So you'll have a lot of references to LPAs instead of PAs, and it's a registered specialist assistant. Okay, this change that's referred to in this slide is who has to document the supervision. So we know that PAs are subject to the supervision of the physician that they work with, and this regulation says it's up to the PA, the LPA, or the registered special assistant to document continuous supervision by the physician that they're working with. So an LPA can issue prescriptions for patients who are under the care of that LPA's supervising physician, and then on the script, which will be the physician's script, both the doctor's name and information and the PA's information, or LPA, excuse me, information should be included. An LPA, that includes the prescription of controlled substances, and again, it's limited to patients who are under the care of the physician that's supervising that LPA. It has to be within the scope of that physician's practice that those controlled substances are being prescribed, and then, you know, the PA has to indicate their information on the electronic prescription as well as the physician's. An LPA who's employed in a hospital would do the same thing, but would do it on the hospital prescription form, and would have to, again, include both their information and the physician's information. The physician supervision rules haven't changed with respect to numbers, just a little nuance that I wanted to mention. So, you know, just review from past years, when it's in a private office, it's one physician to four PAs and two RSAs. No more than that can be supervised by a single physician. In the hospitals, it's more, it's at six. And what the new change is the LPA or RSA does not have to be an employee of the hospital. As long as they're working in the hospital, they're subject to that, you know, 1-6 ratio. So they don't have to be employed or contracted by the hospital. They just have to be working in the hospital at the time to be on that 1-6 ratio. So you probably heard a lot in the news about the Doc Fix bill and, you know, what was going to happen with that. There was a lot of press coverage, and one of the things it did was include these provisions for physician performance standards and quality measures that are required to be reported pursuant to the federal legislation. So as an accommodation or sort of a compromise measure, the statute also says that while physicians are required to provide this information, that information can't be turned around and used in a medical malpractice lawsuit. So that's been an issue that we've been concerned about with state legislation, which requires a lot of reporting about how many incidents and what types of incidents, and this one specifically says, yes, you have to provide it, but no plaintiff's attorney, you can't then say to a jury, look at how many problems this doctor has had based upon what is provided pursuant to statute. So moving along to the cases that have taken place, first I'm going to talk about privilege when it's a physician-patient privilege. So there are physician-patient privileges, there are attorney-client privileges, there are, you know, all number of privileges, but these first two cases address the medical privilege. So in this case, a plaintiff sued a surgeon and a surgery center for malpractice in the performance of her two surgeries, that her surgeries weren't appropriately performed. She alleged that the surgery center knew or should have known that this physician practicing in the hospital or in the surgery center was committing malpractice because the surgeon would report what surgeries were done to the surgery center. So today I did these 10 procedures and this is the nature of these 10 procedures. So what the plaintiff was essentially saying is you can look at this many, you know, that there are, you know, 10 complicated surgeries on this day, and obviously mine wasn't done well because the surgeon was rushing through them, had too many surgeries, that sort of thing. That was the allegation. So the plaintiff moved to compel the surgery center to disclose a list of all the surgeries that were performed on the dates that she had her two surgeries, so she could show it to the jury and say, see, this is evidence of, you know, that my surgery, you know, there was one too many, essentially. And the defendants opposed, said, no, that's privileged information. Those other patients shouldn't have their information disclosed because this plaintiff wants this information, and it's subject to the physician-patient privilege. The appellate division, the second court to hear the case, said the log has to be disclosed, but it can be redacted. So it's going to be disclosed with the type of surgery and the number of surgeries, but all the patient identifying information would not be included, which is somewhat of a, you know, it protects the patient, is somewhat of a compromise, protects the patient's, the non-plaintiff patient's information while still giving the plaintiff the ability to prove her case, which was ultimately what the court felt was the privacy interests were adequately protected. And then, you know, it also gave the plaintiff the opportunity to examine those records and make a determination and an argument to the jury. This is another physician-patient case. This is actually the Court of Appeals, which is, so Supreme Court, Appellate Division, Court of Appeals, it's our highest court in New York. And in this case, a defendant, who ultimately was a criminal defendant, while seeking treatment from a psychiatrist, admitted to sexually abusing an 11-year-old family member. The physician made the mandated report, to the Administration for Children's Services, and subsequently at the criminal trial of that patient for sexually abusing the child, the psychiatrist was called to the stand and asked to disclose this admission, and the court directed that was an appropriate question, and the psychiatrist did disclose the admission that had been made during the treatment process. The court's reasoning or thinking in allowing that testimony was the privilege had already been waived by the fact that this, this information had already been disclosed to an administrative agency. And on appeal, the court said, no, wrong. Just because you have a duty to disclose it to an agency or an entity doesn't mean that the physician-patient privilege is waived for all purposes. The psychiatrist's reporting obligation doesn't abrogate the physician-patient privilege. So what happened was a new trial was granted for that defendant, and that information won't be discoverable or admissible. So the next kind of privilege that I'm going to talk about is when preparing a case, and I thought these cases were relevant to when you're looking at an incident in your facilities and deciding, you know, what's going to be discoverable or not. If it's under the quality assurance, umbrella, then certainly there's that privilege. But there may also be a privilege that comes about with respect to attorney involvement. So if an attorney is involved, there's a couple of different privileges that can come into play. In this case, it was a plaintiff attorney pro se, so it was a wife of a patient who brought the lawsuit. And while her husband was in the hospital, she conducted an interview of a hospital employee with a tape recording. Then the lawsuit proceeds, and a request is made by the defense, hey, we want to hear what our employee said to you on this tape recording. And the attorney says, no, it's protected, it's attorney work product because I'm an attorney, and it's material prepared for litigation. So there's a couple of different kinds of privileges under the statute. The first one is the attorney work product privilege, and that's an absolute privilege. If it's found that something is subject to the attorney work product privilege, there's no disclosure of that. There's no, you know, but we still really need it, so we're going to work around that. You know, it's absolute. So it is really limited to an attorney's thought process, a strategy, that sort of thing. So if you just get a statement, like in this case, you're just taking a recording of another person, unless you're including your strategy or your thoughts as to what their responses are, that's not going to be an attorney work product, because it's really just a factual account that you're getting from a witness. So in this case, the court said it's not attorney work product, so it's not going to be protected from that. It didn't have any opinion or analysis. They also put a kind of a question mark, but didn't really rule on it, because the plaintiff pro se at the time that she was making the interview was acting as a wife of a patient. Was she really working as an attorney at that point? And, you know, that was a more difficult question, so the court didn't decide it. So the next they looked at, would this be material prepared for litigation? And the key thing with material prepared for litigation is that has to be the sole purpose. You can't be preparing it for purposes of, you know, your investigative process or your quality process, as well as for litigation, as well as for, you know, then you lose the privilege. And even if it is material prepared for litigation privilege, that's a conditional privilege. So even if the court finds that this is material prepared for litigation, meaning I just made it for purposes of trying this case, the court can still say, I'm going to allow disclosure of it because it's material and necessary to the other side to have that information. In this case, there was no lawsuit at the time. There was no indication that it was prepared for a lawsuit. So they said it's not privileged under material prepared for litigation either, and the attorney was required to disclose it to the defense. This is a case that we actually get a fair number of questions about, and it sort of ties in with the telemedicine. When you don't have face-to-face contact with a patient, at what point does your involvement create a physician-patient relationship such that you can be subject to medical malpractice liability? In this case, a young boy is seen in the emergency department for a dog bite on his face. The PA sees the child, calls the plastic surgeon, who's purportedly on Fire Island at the time, and discusses the case, and you know, the plastic surgeon makes the determination based upon the telephone conversation that it's not necessary for him to come in and see the patient or address the laceration, and has the PA, you know, do the suturing. And it turns out that the PA sutures the child's face without sedation beyond the time that it was medically advisable. Guess what? There's a lawsuit. The patient's mother sues both the plastic surgeon, who never came to the hospital, and the hospital. The defendant plastic surgeon moves for summary judgment, saying, hey, I never saw this patient. I don't have a physician-patient relationship, and therefore the patient can't sue me. And the court says, well, yes, you did have a physician-patient relationship, because your advice was conveyed to mom through the PA. So that connecting conversation was enough to create a physician-patient relationship. Summary judgment is denied. The lawsuit's going to go forward against both the hospital and the plastic surgeon, even though the plastic surgeon didn't see the child. This is another duty case, and this case actually has some pretty significant implications for what's going to happen next. And you know, I'll certainly be talking about it next year when we find out what's going to happen next. It's a case where a patient driver goes to the emergency room at 7:27 in the morning with abdominal pain, gets narcotics, and then is discharged shortly after the narcotics. Hops in the car, and while driving the vehicle, crosses the double yellow line and hits a bus coming in the other direction. Fortunately, the bus is unoccupied, but obviously, except for the driver, who is injured. And then there is a lawsuit by the bus driver against the hospital and the doctor who saw the patient in the emergency room. Now, you know, you may remember we talked about a case, the Fox case, which was a horrible case where a mental health patient was given a day pass and went out on the day pass and killed and dismembered a neighbor while out on the day pass. And then there was a lawsuit brought by the, you know, the family of that, you know, the victim against the hospital, saying, you know, you had the opportunity. I know we don't have a physician-patient relationship, but you had an opportunity to control the behavior of this patient because you granted the patient the day pass. So in that case, summary judgment was denied on a negligence claim, saying maybe, maybe not, we'll see. Ultimately, that case did settle. But in this case, it's a little bit more attenuated because in the Fox case, the patient was coming back to the facility, had been granted a limited window of time that they were permitted to leave the facility, so there was a much better argument that the patient was under the control of the facility at the time that the crime was committed. In this case, the patient had been treated and discharged. So was there a sufficient basis to hold the hospital and the doctor liable for this third party injury? The court found no, there was not. That the hospital didn't have the opportunity to control the behavior of the patient that they had discharged. You know, the argument being that you gave the patient narcotics and allowed the patient to drive, right? There was no medical malpractice liability. So what did the plaintiff do? They tried to amend their complaint to say there was ordinary negligence. So then there doesn't have to be a physician-patient relationship if it's just ordinary negligence. And the allegation, like the Fox case, is that you had enough authority to stop this patient from driving. Either you don't give them narcotics, you make them wait until the narcotics aren't effective, you tell them they can't drive, whatever the case may be. But the, you know, the court, the Supreme Court, and then the appellate division both held that there was no liability. But the leave to appeal to the Court of Appeals, so it's not an automatic appeal. They had to ask for permission to go up to the highest court, and it was granted. So right now, briefs have been filed by both sides. Amicus briefs, those friend of the court briefs by interested parties who aren't directly involved, have been filed by the Medical Society and by the Healthcare Association of New York, because this could have huge implications for healthcare providers if after your patient leaves your office, you're still responsible for what the patient does. So we'll be very interested to see what, you know, what comes out of this case. You know, there's been a lot of changes. The Court of Appeals is almost 100% changed in terms of membership. It's mostly newer judges who have been appointed by the last by Governor Cuomo, and so, you know, it remains to be seen what's going to happen with this very important decision. Going back to the Fox case, where the motion for summary judgment was denied, that case settled recently. And typically, when cases settle, we as defendants will ask for a confidentiality provision in the settlement. That, you know, the doctor, the hospital, the medical provider doesn't want it splashed on somebody's website or newspaper that there was this big verdict taken against them. So we ask for confidentiality, that they can't post that information publicly. In this case, the plaintiff's family asked for confidentiality of this case because it was just such a, you know, nightmare. They didn't want to, you know, and the court said no. So the court refused confidentiality to the plaintiff who actually brought the lawsuit and said, this is an important enough issue that the public needs to know about this. So you know, it's really, you know, caught the interest of you know, legal scholars as to what's going to take place in that case. This is an interesting case because a lot of providers or more nursing homes than anything, but, you know, facilities, different people are looking at, can we have an arbitration clause when we treat a patient, when we admit a patient, that any disputes between us will be resolved through arbitration as opposed to through a lawsuit. And in this case, it was a patient was admitted, you know, was injured while in the nursing home, and a lawsuit was brought by the son for, you know, for that injury. So as you know, there's a provision of public health law, 2801D, that creates a private right of action for violations of patients' rights while they're inside the nursing home. And one of the provisions contained in the law says that any waiver of a patient's right to bring a lawsuit, to have a jury review their lawsuit, is null and void. So, you know, this was brought against the, no, you can't rely on that arbitration clause because that would deprive the patient of the right to have a jury trial, and therefore it's null and void. But the court, the appellate court, said, you know, no, that's not the case, because the arbitration clause is governed by the Federal Arbitration Act. And there's this thing called preemption, which if the federal government has already spoken, the state government is not allowed to contradict that. We can add to it, but we can't contradict it. So in this case, it did contradict it because the Arbitration Act said you could do this. The public health law said you couldn't, so the federal statute wins. So the arbitration clause was upheld. So, you know, the question is for the future, what more are we going to see of people trying to use arbitration clauses to avoid the cost and time and everything else that comes with drawn out court litigation? This is a punitive damages case, and I think I noticed a little too late in the game that John has written a great article on punitive damages in medical malpractice cases, so I'd be happy to get it to you, or, you know, John shared his contact information. He and a partner wrote an article about how punitive damages generally aren't allowed in medical malpractice cases, but this is a case where they were allowed. So again, this is another case that we're really watching very carefully to see what's going to happen. And you'll see why. In this case, tragic case, infant plaintiff is seen by an endocrinologist, and you know, the doctor sees the patient, writes down what she refers to as her scribbles, which are her handwritten note of the interaction with the patient. When the lawsuit's commenced and a request for the medical records is made, the defendant doctor transcribes the notes into typewritten form. Okay, no problem with that. Discloses the typewritten form. The problem happens is that she then decided to throw out the written ones, so they're no longer available. She retained the first one because she considered that the patient's registration form because it contained more information, but the next two visits, which turned out to be pivotal in the medical malpractice lawsuit, were thrown out. So not surprisingly, in the subsequent medical malpractice lawsuit, plaintiff says, yeah, because the smoking gun was in the written ones, and then when she transcribed them, she got rid of the information that was going to hurt you. So they sought punitive damages against the doctor for getting rid of those notes. So it was a failure to diagnose type 1 diabetes, and what was pivotal was, so the last time that the patient was seen, was the next appointment 4 weeks out or was it 8 weeks out? And the infant died between week four and week eight of the, you know, of the purported failure to diagnose. So it was very significant. In the typewritten note of the last visit, it says come back in 4 weeks. But when the patient went up to the registration to get that follow-up appointment, an appointment is made for the patient to come back in 8 weeks. And the patient says, the mother says, the doctor told me 8 weeks. So, but the typewritten note says 4 weeks. So the, you know, was it changed? Where's that note? So that's that. It went to a jury trial, and relatively modest awards were made by the jury: $400,000 pain and suffering, $1,000 pecuniary or economic loss, $7.5 million in punitive damages against the doctor. Which punitive damages aren't covered by insurance policies by the state of New York, right? So huge award. The judge reduced the award to $1.2 million, but it's still an uncovered punitive damages award of $1.2 million for a doctor who tried to clean up her chart. So appeals have been taken in this case as well. Again, it's very rare to get punitive damages in medical malpractice. It's more of a an intentional, willful, malicious conduct. Generally, something that's against a group of people or society in general. It's not like you breached a contract between me and you. It's something that goes much further than that. But in this case, it was alleged there was a willful failure to maintain and disclose those medical records. And the lower court sustained that punitive damages award, said that the jury could have looked at it and found that the physician's actions were wantonly dishonest or in disregard of the infant plaintiff's rights. So, And then the court went on to say punitive damages were a good device in this case because they would be an important deterrent to other providers who might be inclined to, make adjustments to their medical records or destroy some of their medical records. Appeals have been filed by both parties, and briefs haven't yet been filed, but the Medical Society has again just decided that they'll be submitting an amicus brief, given the huge implications for all medical providers in the state. The next case is a statute of limitations case. It involves a three-year-old. So as you know, the statute of limitations in your typical medical malpractice case is 2.5 years. But when you're talking about an infant, there's an infancy toll for the period until the child reaches majority. So in this case, plaintiff undergoes surgery at the age of 3. And there's a plastic catheter placed at the time of the heart surgery to record atrial pressure. When it comes out, after the surgery, a nurse makes a note in the chart, and remarkably, 23 years later, the chart was still available, makes a note in the chart that a portion of the catheter was left behind. So there's where the lawsuit was seated. So 17 years later, plaintiff goes on to have a number of problems, which result in scans and other providers saying, hey, by the way, you have a foreign object that was left in you. Turns out it was the catheter fragment and it was removed. So now the patient at the age of 26, 23 years after the heart surgery, is bringing a lawsuit against the hospital and the surgeon for the three-year-old surgery, okay? So statute of limitations has clearly run, right? Because it's 23 years later. The defendants move to dismiss, say the statute of limitations is run. The catheter was an intentionally placed fixation device, and it's not a foreign object. The plaintiff counters it was a foreign object. The reason that it matters is that there's a special statute of limitations for foreign object cases, because the thought is if somebody leaves a sponge in you and you don't know about it, how can you bring the lawsuit until you know about it? So there's this special provision, 214A, which delays accrual. So basically, accrual means when the statute of limitations starts running or starts, clicks on for that, expiration time. So in a foreign object case, it's the date of discovery or when you reasonably should have discovered that there's a foreign object in you, and then there's 1 year from that accrual date to bring the lawsuit. So if you don't find it until 10 years after the treatment, or you don't reasonably couldn't have found out, it would be at that 10-year mark that 1 year would start running. But it does accept, among other things, fixation devices. So if somebody puts in something intentionally that has a medical purpose, that's a fixation device. In this case, the catheter was not a fixation device. It didn't have a purpose, is what the court found. And the court likened it to a surgical clamp that was left behind, that was significant during the surgery, but not significant thereafter, and therefore wasn't appropriate to have been left behind. Therefore, the action was timely, despite the fact that it wasn't commenced for 23 years. So significant statute of limitations. There's been a lot of talk. I imagine that you've seen some press about something called Laverne's Law. And this is what do we have to look forward to or not in the coming year? So Laverne was an unfortunate woman who had a chest x-ray which had evidence of the cancer, the lung cancer that ultimately killed her or took her life. By the time she learned that the x-ray showed her lung cancer, the statute of limitations had run. What none of the press tells anyone, because it wouldn't be a popular fact, is the city paid her anyway, even though the statute of limitations had run, because they felt bad at what had happened. They felt that there was an injustice there. But anyway, it's become this battle cry, Laverne's Law. How can these people be left without a remedy? So the legislature is very seriously considering changing the statute of limitations in medical malpractice cases to allow for accrual to run from discovery. So in a case like Laverne, it wouldn't be until she found out that the x-ray showed her lung cancer and that was a cause of injury. So it requires that, the two things. So here's what the proposed language is. When you know or reasonably know of an alleged negligent act or omission, and you know that it has caused an injury. So it's a lot of things to know before your time even starts to run. for medical malpractice liability in that time frame to expire. So we're expecting that it's going to be reintroduced again this year. It has strong support. There's strong support from the plaintiff's bar, from some of the sponsors who are plaintiff's attorneys and legislators, and obviously strong opposition from the medical community. And the medical community has been speaking up. We'll have more for you next year at the legal update as to how it all comes out. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And otherwise, okay.
What is your advice now to that plastic surgeon and other people who get called, and the conversation between the ER physician and the physician on the phone is that I don't really need to come in, this really isn't something for me, even though they've talked about it? I mean, it will come up again.
Oh, certainly it will. And it's a tough answer, or not an easy answer, because it's really fact specific. You know, in that case, since there were all those things that took place that were inappropriate after that conversation, it almost, was a lock that plastic surgeon was going to be sued, because in the family's eyes, the child was left with someone who was unqualified or unable to do what needed to be done. What the courts look at when they're deciding these cases is how specific it gets. It's kind of like any curbside consult. So if you call up and ask a general urology question of your urology colleague without the specifics of the patient, the closer you get to those specifics, the more likely it is that it will be sustained that you're going to be held in for medical malpractice. So, in this case, the plastic surgeon knew it was a two-year-old, knew about the laceration, what type of laceration was described in detail, knew that it would be a PA who was going to be doing the procedure if the plastic surgeon didn't come in. So there was just too much information, and assessment was made over the phone. So it wasn't more in the nature of general medical advice. It was really specific to, based upon what I'm hearing about this laceration, I don't think I need to be the one to suture it. And that's, so if someone's getting into that kind of detail, come on in, come in and take a look. And because a consultation, it's going to be noted in the medical record. It's, the PA doesn't want to walk away from that and say, I made this determination. So they're going to write right in the medical record, I called the plastic surgeon, and he said he's not coming in, and it's up to me. That's like a smoking gun for a plaintiff's attorney when they see that. So if they're going to be getting into a patient-specific consultation, they're exposed.
Under the licensed physician assistants, shall retain records documenting continuous supervision. What's the definition of continuous supervision?
And what documentation is going to be enough to we had this, Matt and I had this conversation. Is that enough that there's a time clock that, I was here at the same time as that? Because it doesn't mean you're next to me. It means you're available to me. So if I have a question or I need assistance, I need counsel, you're available to me for that purpose. No. Could you just wait for the mic and just repeat it one time here?
Does that mean physically in the department?
It does not. It can be, but it doesn't have to be, as long as a physician is available for consultation.
My question has to do with QA reviews. More and more, we're more transparent, and our QA reviews, peer reviews, and so on go up.
Judy, could you see if the mic is? I don't think the mic might not be on. Is it on?
All right. My question has to do with QA reviews, and more it's transparent and goes up the chain all the way up to the board. Are there anything that we can do? Anything we can do to make sure that it remains protected, even as it is? It may show up in board minutes, for example.
I'm having a hard time. I didn't fully understand the question. So you're saying in QA reviews, if the QA information is used for other purposes?
Nope, it shows up and it's presented to the board sometimes.
Uh-huh.
We make efforts to de-identify it, you know, but it's in the minutes, it will be easy to figure out that yes, it.
So in the minutes of your board meeting, it addressed QA, but it didn't identify a patient.
No. I mean, clearly the names are not there. You know, clearly the date of birth are not there, and so on. But it could be easily tied to a case.
Right.
Just because of the greater transparency.
Right.
That comes
well,
out.
Generally, for the quality assurance privilege to protect information, it has to be limited to the quality assurance process. Fran, you want to add?
The board is the ultimate governing authority of the Article 28 facility, and the board is responsible for all quality assurance actions. So one of the solutions to that is the board can sit as part of the QA process and hear that QA action. It's almost like you don't have to, you know, formally, it's like going into executive session. It's like that kind of a thing. And you can put it under your structure, so it's not like just a general board meeting and you're talking about QI, but the board will sit as the ultimate authority of that QI process. So I would suggest that in your minutes that you indicate that the board is convening as the ultimate QI authority of the institution. Put your QI information in that portion of the board minutes and then go back to your regular board business.
Right, and Judy, could you bring the mic over to Donnie? That's the really important thing, is it stays to Donnie over here. So it stays quality assurance material if everything is lining up, that this is quality assurance, whether it's the quality assurance meeting, whether it's a special session of the board, but it is for that that quality assurance purpose, and it's not becoming a multi-purpose document.
And I would also suggest that when you do give out information in writing, that you number it and get it back at the end so it does not go out of the hospital. We have had situations where the hospitals have said, oh, we can't make our board members do that. We're going to send it through the mail, and you know, God knows what happens. It goes to their homes, and who else sees it? So my suggestion is you give it out in a numbered fashion, and you get it back in a numbered fashion, and make sure you have it, because that's the only way to protect the QA privilege.
And because the minutes are documenting everything and you know that's taken place, those are certainly going to be requested by a plaintiff's attorney. And you know they shouldn't be discoverable, but likely what will happen is a judge will take those minutes and go through them and do an in-camera inspection as to whether or not there is anything that's discoverable. And you just don't want to give that opportunity.
I'd like to go back to the LPA question. So documentation, is that the schedule that we retain, or are you expecting something in documentation to say who is supervising, especially in like a group practice where there are several doctors in the practice on the floor with the PAs?
There is not any clarification to this very new provision at this point as to what the documentation requirements are. You know, we do know that there is not a requirement that the physician be on the floor with the PA. But the PA needs to be able to satisfy someone at a future time that they weren't practicing without supervision. So, you know, it's going to take some case law and some experience, but certainly, you know, if a schedule shows that, you know, the PA for this practice is on at the same time as the physician is on and the PA maintains that, you know, the big thing being that now that they're putting that obligation, that onus on the PA, so the PA needs to look out for themselves and make sure that they can justify that they were continuously supervised during their treatment times. All right, well, thank you very much.